Hi, everyone. Happy 2020. This is episode 14 of the Parent Teacher Podcast. The purpose of this podcast is to talk about issues that involve the way that we are educating children and preparing them for happy and independent adulthood, I guess. I'm Casey. I'm your host. I'm a former teacher, a parent. I have ADHD. I frequently work with kids and families who are labeled twice exceptional or who have ADHD or other learning challenges. And so I like to have conversations with people about relevant topics. I'm going to stop and let my guest today, Robin, tell this quick story about what happens when we have kids that are always working on their areas of weakness and not in their areas of strength.
Research project at the University of Connecticut was with young adults with Williams syndrome, and they tend to have, well, they have 10 times the average perfect pitch. I mean, so they are also rhythmically sound. They have an affinity for music on the whole. This is a group that will never be spatially competent. Just not going to happen. And they aren't wired mathematically, okay? In those kids that we brought on the university campus for a residence program, only one ever had any hint of music, and these were post-secondary, had a hint of music in all of their public education because they were always being remediated for math. Which they never were going to.
That's pretty powerful. That's a really powerful example.
So Robin was introduced to me by John from Bridges Academy, a connection I made when I was in California for a conference late last year. And I had planned to just have a conversation with her on the phone, but as she started to talk to me and tell me stories, I realized that I really didn't want her to have to repeat them. So I asked if we could just go, and she agreed. She shared so many resources with me that I am going to just kind of paste them in at the back end of this. And her book is on Amazon, To Be Gifted and Learning Disabled. Talks about strengths-based approaches, and I will likely have her come back and talk more about the learning profile that she developed. I have been looking for someone to talk to about gifted education because of my own background, which was in special education. And I figured there'd be a good deal of overlap, but also that we would have something to learn from each other. And Robin was a great fit. I, at one point, was teaching a course on special education methods for a summer program. So, one of those fast and furious summer courses. And as I was looking through the textbook and covering all the different topics, intellectual disability and Down syndrome and autism and ADHD and learning disabilities, there's a chapter on gifted education. And I thought, I can't give a lot of priority to this because I have all this other stuff to cover. And as I was reading it, I found a statistic on dropout rates and the at-risk population of gifted kids. My own work, I work with a lot of kids who are really struggling to fit in school. And so I thought that it was definitely not something that should be skipped over. And I think that Robin has some really awesome insight, whether you're a parent or a teacher, into how we can serve these kids better. So her first question to me was, do you want me to talk about gifted education or twice exceptional learners? And then I think we rolled into what we can agree is just this universal truth of learners, particularly when their skills are asynchronous is the word I'll use, or their skills are really staggered, really discrepant, high highs, low lows. And so here Robin is going to teach us.
Well, what's interesting about that is that it is not the characteristic of being gifted. It's really about fitting in a classroom setting. And thinking about if you are in a place that you don't fit or feel comfortable, let's go back to Maslow, if you don't have that sense of belonging, mm-hmm. then you don't learn optimally. So that's why you're at risk. And as if we can keep kids feeling safe and engaging, that's a real key. One of the things I would recommend as a shortcut for your parents or for anyone, Susan Baum and I work together on a daily basis, and our text is To Be Gifted and Learning Disabled, came out in 2017, but we also wrote the manuals for both the movies, the documentaries, 2E, Twice Exceptional, and Teaching the Twice Exceptional. And these manuals are available online as PDFs. But within it, there's a really, what I personally think is a great explanation for discussion, is this is what 2E looks like. And we call it green. See across the top? Mm-hmm. That all of us have, or at some times and under some circumstances, we have yellow. That's when we're cruising. Those are the things we do well at, where we feel most comfortable and actualized. That's yellow. Blue is the special ed side. What are the challenges that stand in the way of our learning optimally? And very often in school settings, people will say, oh, will we take care of the gifted side by giving some enrichment? And then we take care of the blue side because we do remediation. Mm-hmm. And maybe we'll do some accommodations, but you gotta have, in fact, we're gonna start with the remediation. Who does best when they're doing what they can't do?
Right.
So we realized it was like this light bulb moment that these kids are not blue and yellow. They are green. Their gifts, they don't leave them at the door when they enter the special ed classroom. And their challenges, they don't put them away either. They come as a package. So we need to be really clever and what we call dual differentiate. Mm-hmm. And in dual differentiation, those, it takes into account what they can't do. I mean, we call that when you do just the yellow and just the blue separately, we call that the Band-Aid approach. Mm-hmm. And it is not successful. Highly verbal, highly intelligent kids in a social skills class will run the class, be defiant. They don't have anything in common. They don't find things to really learn in there. I think you'll agree with me. Mm-hmm. And then in a gifted literature class, no matter how bright that dyslexic child is, he or she is going to feel behind and pressured. Well, they don't fit in either. And that's why the chart, what you see is the gifted.
So I'm going to explain too, in case it goes to the audio of the podcast. So what Robin's showing me is a three column chart, and in the far right column is the yellow, the high abilities or potential in one or more areas, right? And then the blue column, so at the top of the blue column, there's a box that says exceptionality. And then that lists the things that we'd think of as disabilities or learning challenges, specific learning disability, ADHD, ODD, generalized anxiety disorder, ASD. And what's AND at the bottom here? Additional, kind
it's
of a catch-all?
Additional exceptionalities and acronyms.
Got it. So is she, yeah.
What it looks like.
Mm-hmm. So on the one side, we have the strengths, which are described as being yellow. On the other side, we have these challenges, which are blue, and we're saying it's the student is a whole person. The student is not yellow and blue. The student is green.
And this is available online for download.
Okay. All right. And I'll make sure that I put that link in the show notes. Yeah, as well. You know, and Robin, what I'm thinking of is this morning, I think I told you a little earlier, I've been thinking about the way that I reach out to parents and to teachers is to kind of examine different, I think of it as like a vocabulary lesson. And the one I was thinking about this morning was scaffolding. Like, what is scaffolding and what are the zones of proximal development? Because as an advocate, when I go into to work with a family and a school team with a student, I think that this is one of the biggest challenges we see, is that the student shows this tremendous potential to do tasks because of some of these areas of strength. You know, exceptional vocabulary, creativity in writing, and yet they're not performing. And so then you hear, you know, the teacher saying, well, they're not motivated if they just tried harder. And I'm like, no, let's think back to these zones of development where they are able to do some of these things alone, maybe due to high interest, maybe due to some other, like, you know, I'm like, help me match up my thoughts with, are we talking about pairing interest and strengths with the supports needed? Or am I a little off base?
Let's use those examples again. Let's look a little more deeply at it. If you have a child who is intellectually capable, but is dyslexic, taking that child or keeping that child in a remediated reading group at a very young age is neither stimulating his cognitive abilities, that's on one side, but it is simultaneously exposing that child and what that child cannot do to his or her peers. We are in effect shaming a bright child. We aren't developing their skills. We're saying, hey, you need to be fixed. And we don't want that fix-it mode. So what might we consider? What if we considered poetry? The words are simple, the concepts are deep. There's not a ton of words on the page. It's not dense. Let's look at Emily Dickinson, for example. A word is dead when it is said. Some say, I say, it just begins to live that day. We're honoring that child's cognitive capacity. And then that the remediation can take place contextually and not publicly as an exposure. So for me, I can't sing. I can hear well. I have, you know, relative pitch. I want to be able to sing. It's one of the things when I come back in my next life, top of the list. Singing in languages, it's the same issue. I can hear but not replicate. What if singing was a core in a class?
Yeah.
It was reading, math, and singing. What if every day I needed to go sing in front of my classmates? What if, because the way I'm wired, I cannot produce? There's some connection. I might be able to get better. But I was doing, as a student, I exchanged in Brazil. And I was so excited because a guitar teacher said he could teach. He asked me why I wasn't singing with the group. And I said, well, at church, they tell me just to hum. So, and he said, oh, don't worry. He said, I can teach anyone to sing. I was so excited. I went to his studio the next day. And at the end of 45 minutes, he said, so maybe I was wrong.
Oh, no. Yeah.
Okay, so now consider what I would be like today if every day I had to share what I couldn't do. We do that to these kids. I would shut down. I promise you, I would be, what did you call it? You call them school refusal. Mm-hmm. I would have refused a long time ago. I don't know if you've read much of Robert Sternberg's work, but his book on successful intelligence is fascinating because he talks about when we go into a situation, we check right away if we fit.
Yeah.
Going to think of going to a party. Mm-hmm. You kind of look around. Do you fit? Well, ooh, this seems to be a little more business. I'm going to straighten my back. I'm going to put on my very best business affect. You try to fit. If that doesn't work, you try to change the environment so it fits you. You like take the mic and you do a bit of stand-up. If that doesn't work, if they're not buying, the only logical thing to do for a bright person is to leave the environment, leave the party. When we see kids leaving the party, we know that they have gone through the steps. They tried to fit. I can't sing. Mm-hmm. I can't read. I can't, whatever it is, I'm not fitting. Then they try to be the class clown or the quiet wallflower at the back. They start shrinking out of it, and ultimately they go to the Bahamas.
Yeah. I'm reminded of that, the cartoon I'm sure everyone's seen. It's the thing about if you're gauging the fish's success by his ability to climb a tree.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
That one's widely circulated. And I agree. I guess your singing is my sports. I've never seen myself as being very, you know, coordinated or quick moving. So yoga is much more, or biking is much more my thing. Because I agree. If I were trying to develop a strong sense of identity and competence by playing basketball against others...
Right.
Not going to happen.
So for these children who have any of this list, that, and if it is what is valued and shown in the classroom, how will that child develop a strong sense of identity? Positive identity.
Now, let me ask a question, because you brought up reading as the earlier example and teaching in context, and I agree. You know, it, especially if we look at some of the models of motivation, right? Competence and efficacy really come into play here. Like, can I do it? Do I think I'm capable of learning this? Do I think the effort that I'm going to put into this is going to pay off? Your example of the professor saying, oh, maybe not. I mean, yeah, that really doesn't build that type of resilience that we want to see in students. And yet, at the same time, I recently did an episode about phonics-based instruction or structured evidence-based instruction. And so what do you think of, is there a way in which we work to our strengths, and is there a space for looking at those areas, and when do we step back into, I think that Stoic saying, I bring this up all the time, of, you know, the obstacle is the way. You know, in what times do we work around something, I guess, and how do we choose what things we're going to work through?
So you talked earlier about Vygotsky and the zone of proximal development, and you have to want to get in the zone. If you are scaffolding someone and you're holding them at the same time you're trying to push it up, how successful is that? Mm. What you need is someone who wants to get there. And they will want to get there in an area in which they're interested. So we aren't teaching, we aren't just coddling a child by going with strengths. We're using strengths as a very thoughtful, focused entry point. And yes, they need accommodations. They will do better with accommodations, but they need to be invisible accommodations. So that they're available to everyone when they need them. Why shouldn't they be if it's an accommodation? And if our goal is to learn optimally, why shouldn't anyone be able to access an accommodation when they think, wow, I'd learn better if I had that? That's ultimate scaffolding. Mm-hmm. So, and that is what we call dual differentiation again. And that is discussed a little bit. Well, it's discussed at length in the book, but also it's touched on in the little PDF manual. But if you have something that a child wants to do, like debate, a good arguer, you've spotted a good arguer, then you want to coach them and bring them along and say, you know, I have found this, I know reading is a real challenge for you, but I also know that there are some assistive technologies, as well as some programs like Orton Gillingham. Mm-hmm. You know, you start list them, include the child in why you're doing it. I want you to be able to access. You have the potential to be one fine debater. But debaters have to do two big things. They have to have a wealth of knowledge, and you can get that audibly. But access to reading is going to be really good. So let's look at those options over here, and we'll find someone to work with you. You know, coach.
Mm-hmm.
Not remedial, coach.
Right.
And then also, you're going to need to be able to organize your thoughts and get them down on paper. There's all sorts of ways to do that. So let's begin to experiment with that in an action learning approach. Let's see what works. Let's try them. And none of this will be fast. You have to know that that development from novice to expert is a very long path. But I think you're capable.
Let me ask you another question, because one of the things that you asked in the beginning is, are we talking about twice exceptional or are we talking about gifted? And I've always felt, especially when I would work in settings where kids had a lot of behavior impacting learning, this is what you're describing. It's this shutdown when the content isn't a good fit, right? Either in interest or in difficulty or in presentation. If we don't have a good fit of the task that's put in front of the student, or if they lack the choice around the task, that's when we see just engagement decrease across the board in a typical classroom setting. And so I think that what you're describing too is probably, you know, it's every student. It's a little bit every student.
Yes, go ahead. Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, it's okay. What are some ways that, you know, that this learning that you have around the gifted students too, like how do they pull this off in a general public school setting? Are there any resources or this twice differentiation, you know?
Dual differentiation? You bring up just, my head's exploding with the ideas here, but Susan and I developed a suite of tools that we use that work very well in public schools. And it's number one, really knowing the student, but the students knowing the students. Because in this world, we know that in some ways we're like everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We're humans. So there's a match. But in certain ways, we are like others, but not like some others. It's neither good nor bad. It just is. You and I have my hair up today, but you and I have hair that's longer. We match that way. We probably could talk about hair clips or scrunchies, you know, there are some commonalities here. And you said you like yoga. I had a great yoga session yesterday. So understanding where we intersect with others and where we don't allows us to talk about diversity in the largest sense.
Hmm.
But ultimately, we are like no other. We are an individual. And as part of my graduate work, I developed a tool called My Learning Print. It's like a fingerprint. It's how I am a unique learner. And we built the discussions based on that. And then Susan developed a tool called the QPI, the Quick Personality Indicator. And then we have a series of questions and organizational tools, because we believe, and that was my call ahead of you with a principal, we believe that a talent plan, a strength piece, should be on every IEP. It can't go out unless we're doing something to address what that child is good at, because every child deserves to do something each day that makes them feel good.
I agree with you so, so much on that. I recently saw Robert Brooks speaking, and so he, you know, he talks about islands of competence, which really ties into this. And I'm interested, when you say that the piece about the strength should be incorporated, you don't just mean in that statement, because there's nothing worse to me than going to an IEP meeting and they start reading the strengths and they're like, the student is well-groomed, the student is friendly, you know, very, you know, kind to others, likes to be helpful. And I'm like, oh my gosh, but not just a description of areas of strength, but actually including it as part of the mandated education for the student.
Yes, we can do a whole
And so what, I guess, is the next thing that you're curious about? What is it that we should be curious about? As like, and I say all the time, I sometimes think, wow, you really figured this out, Casey. Like, wow, you're really getting good at this. And then I think you are going to look back in 3 years and say, you idiot, you were, what were you thinking? So what is it that we're looking for or looking at next?
For me personally?
Mm-hmm.
There's two things. They're really related, but and they're very emotional, because I firmly believe with every fiber of my being that we take care of our own children first, but if we do not then extend, our children will be growing up in a world in which they don't have colleagues that have the light in their eyes. We have an obligation as humans to make sure that all children, ESL, twice exceptional, special ed, you name it, they need to be brought to the table of learning and valued and respected. Mm-hmm. I am concerned that, and you heard in our earlier mini discussion, that I served on a public school board for 6 years, and I have great respect for public schooling, and I believe that we must have education accessible to every single child. But I also think that the system of standards is crippling us, and that somewhere along the line, groups of us need to have the courage to take care of our children, to widen that net just a little further. In other words, if you do something great for your child, take another child along. Mm-hmm. If your child is suffering in a classroom, chances are there's another one also.
Yeah.
So build it in a positive way, not a complaining, punitive way. So that's got to be there. But I do think that there is a different way to look at education, and that's what I'm working on.
Mm-hmm. And for, we briefly spoke before recording. Robin really came into this because you helped cultivate a program for kids who had high musical aptitude, talent for music, because of
it. That was part of it. I also have a daughter with dyslexia,
mm-hmm.
Who has her teaching credential. But as you had said earlier, every time I think I've got it, oh, there's a gifted child. Oh, this is what 2E is. Oof, I've got it. I do this. I know that's deadly, because another case will present itself.
Right.
And that's why I think, another book you might want to read is Todd Rose's The End of Average, because he's at Harvard, and he's looking at the science of individuality. And when we talk about individuality within a public setting, so many people back up and they say, whoa, I don't have time for that.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa, that's too much on my plate. But if that's what we need to be doing, don't we need to look at it very carefully?
Yeah, yeah.
And you also brought up something about Vygotsky and In the Zone that I think people don't think about very carefully, and that is when you are working above capacity and what you look like, you shut down, right? Or you become a disruptor, or a runner, mm-hmm. you know, you do anything to get out of a situation where you can't learn.
Right.
Like you and I suddenly started speaking in Italian, we would lose most people.
Right. Well, and that I think is the, that to me is the key takeaway for both parents and for teachers, is that just because you see evidence that maybe a child's really mature, you know, maybe a child has incredible emotional regulation and vocabulary, and they speak like they're an adult, and, you know, they have these areas of strength, and then you go to look at their homework and it's a disaster due to executive functioning skills, you know, really a delay maybe in that skill, or, you know, just an underdeveloped skill in planning and prioritizing work independently. And so I think that a lot of times the other reason that kids suffer is because the expectations are not in line with where they are on each skill individually. Where people maybe overgeneralize and look at that child as a whole, and there's a need to break it down into both parts. So.
But, so I have my little Vygotsky card.
Oh, good.
Here. I'm kind of like what I do. Anyway, but above the line,
mm-hmm.
interestingly, and I think you'll agree with me, that the same behaviors would be apparent if you were below the line.
Yes. Yep.
You would still check out. You would, so how do we know, as parents and as teachers, if we're shooting too high or shooting too low? That's got to be in that conversation using the suite of tools. It's got to be in that whole piece with the child, because I was just working with a super, super bright 13-year-old in Australia last month, and she was born to be a mathematician, but she's having a lot of problems in math. The problem? Part of the problem. Not all of the problem, I don't want to minimize. But the math class is so below her level that she goes to the Bahamas. And while she's in the Bahamas, some critical but small piece of information is conveyed to the classroom. Mm. She checks back in and then cannot do the homework because she's missing a piece.
Right.
She knows she's really bright, so she can't shame herself and ask. She also can't expose the fact that she went to the Bahamas for 3 or 4 minutes, maybe 20. But she can't expose it, so she has to cover it up. So she goes home and tries to figure it out herself, but she can't do that because that takes too long, so she doesn't know how to start. And then when she starts, she can't quite figure out what she missed, so she can't finish. So then the next day just piles on.
Right. Right.
And piles on. So you can have these two qualities simultaneously, all three. You can be in the zone, you can be bored out of your mind, and you can also have something that is too difficult at the moment because you're missing a piece of info.
That's really a really interesting way to think of that. I'm not really, because you're executing several skills at once. I guess, you know, my key advice, if you're a parent or you're a teacher and you're trying to figure this out, you can feel there's a mismatch sometimes. Yes. Without really being able to put your finger on it. And it can be just so validating to a person to be able to name and maybe even quantify some of these things. So when I work with a family, one of the first things we do is push for the testing. The district may say, you know, they get 99th percentile on these tests, so there's no need to do the cognitive assessment or to do the achievement test. And I'm like, no, like, information is helpful. Information gives us the power to identify, you know, what is going on. And then I think from your take, it's what do I want then to do. Yes. With that information.
Yes. Do you see the atom?
Mm-hmm.
This is some of Joe Renzulli and Sally Reese's work. And what that means is that behaviors show in certain people, not all people, at certain times, not all times, and under certain circumstances, not all circumstances. So if I know when you are at your best, by using suite of tools and observations, if I know when you're at your best, then that gives me a real clue into how the times and circumstances that I can engage you. Same with the problem behaviors. If I know what puts you over the edge, is it lack of sleep? Is it too much noise? Is it distraction?
Right.
How do we deal with that? So looking at a child with that suite of tools with that includes psychoeducational assessments, but knowing that, what do we want to see more of in a classroom? And what do we want to see less of?
Good.
Really simple question.
It is. It's a really good point. Who was the author on that, Adam, again? Or...
Oh, the Adam?
Yeah.
This is from Joe Renzulli and Sally Reese's work. It's in the pamphlet.
Okay.
You'll see it in here.
Okay, I'll describe that one because I think that that's a really good point as well.
Oh, it's my favorite. That's Susan Baum, my partner in crime, and she's known as, you know, the mother of the Chewy movement, but she says, oh, Robin, you explain everything with the app.
No, but as an advocate, if I were to walk into a school where a child is starting to shut down or the work isn't being completed or we're seeing refusal, one of the first questions we should be asking is, what's going on in that class at that time of day?
What we really ask, the first question is, when is this child at his best?
Uh-huh.
That's it. And you ask the parents as well as the teacher or the specialist.
Mm-hmm.
So when is this child doing, when are these behaviors at their least is another way to look at it. But we like to say, when is this child at his or her personal best?
Good point. I like it.
So that's the number one question. Yeah. Then we can build on that. And then also in this booklet, we look at the different wiring, like ASD, dyslexia, and ADHD, and we say, okay, what's the green part of it? What's the yellow part of it? When you were saying that, you know, mm-hmm. they confer other ways to look at the world. What are they? And for this child, what would we want more of in the classroom? For this child, what would we want to see more of?
It's a good point, and I think it runs counter to the way that we approach this with the special ed perspective, where we're supposed to, we're always listing child strengths, but I feel like it's often very superficial. And then we go right into how do we remediate and how do we work on all of these things that bring this child very little joy right now. So a little counterproductive. Keeping you for so long, but thank you.
What a pleasure to meet you.
So finally, I did cut out a few little areas where we were talking about things that we could see. So you know, we were on a Zoom call, but my computer didn't record it. So there were some visuals, unfortunately, that are kind of lost in the shuffle here. I'm doing my best to link resources and share them with you in the show notes. And then I am working on a YouTube video that will also have the audio and some key slides in there. However, if you have questions about any of the resources that were discussed, or if you have further questions or want to contact me, you can find me at my website, www.reorientededucation.com. You can also leave a message for me through the Anchor FM app, which is who hosts the podcast. So I hope that was helpful. Take care, everybody.